great job this morning on that long passage and for pointing out that the passage that I gave you was the wrong one, had absolutely nothing to do with today's message. So you saved me. So I'm thankful for Garrison. I don't know who's more thankful that Stan is back, me or the rest of the congregation. When he came in the office the other day, I literally bowed down at his feet, which I usually only do with John. Okay. Sorry, that's just between John and me. I'm also thankful that my daughter Angela is here, and my son-in-law Joel over there, and Julian, and Isabel is gone. Is that right? Isabel, she's a nuclear power plant. There's one south of here, and there's Isabel. Okay. Okay, do we have the... So Morgan Spurlock, he set out to make a movie, and he ended up being a crusader, and all it took was 5,000 calories a day. Stuff from a Thanksgiving dinner in 2002, he saw a news report about two teenagers suing McDonald's for allegedly causing their weight gain and health problems. What would happen, he wondered, on that Thanksgiving afternoon if he ate nothing but McDonald's for 1 month? Now, have you heard of this story? Watch the movie. Anyone here? Few people. Okay, I'm not sure it showed here in El Campo, but so it was a great film, he figured, and critics agree. The 98-minute documentary won Best Directing Prize at the Sundance Film Festival. So to produce Super Size Me, his riveting and often revolting indictment of American eating habits in the fast food industry, he ate nothing but McDonald's during 1 month, breakfast, lunch, and supper, 30 days. He calculated that he ate in that month 30 pounds of sugar and 12 pounds of fat. Okay, so that's about a pound of fat every 3 days or so, less than 3 days. He was monitored by three doctors, and he tried everything on the menu at least once. And whenever they said, "Can I supersize that?" he always said yes. That was his agreement. If they said supersize it, he said yes. Now, probably today when you go in, they don't say supersize it anymore, I think because of this film, okay? And he didn't eat anything that didn't come from McDonald's for 1 month. So in that 1 month, he gained 25 pounds, that's about a pound a day, and he got sick. At the start of his 30-day McDonald's experience, the doctors used words like superb, perfect, and outstanding to describe his blood cholesterol levels and overall health. He had 11% body fat and declared his fitness was above average. He stopped exercising during that month because he didn't think most Americans exercise, so he wanted to have a real experience. And his muscles turned to mush. His body fat after 30 days was 18%. Before long, the doctors who accompanied him called his condition obscene and outrageous, and the liver damage he suffered from just eating McDonald's, they compared it to that an alcoholic suffers on his liver for drinking too much. It took him 14 months to get back to his original weight. So 30 months, it took 14 to get back. Since he finished the film, McDonald's eliminated supersizing and started rolling out healthier choices. Adult Happy Meals with bottled water and salad. And the kids, in their Happy Meal, they get sliced apples. McDonald's is the largest purchaser of apples in the world now because of that. So when your kids eat the Chicken McNuggets, scientists still haven't figured out what a Chicken McNugget is made out of. They get some little sliced apples, so it makes up for all of that, okay? Okay, a second book here is Fast Food Nation, Eric Schlosser's expose on how dependent we are on fast food and the methods of how fast foods are produced. So we want bigger cars and bigger meals and bigger houses. To what end? We spend, at that time, it's now higher, $110 billion each year on fast food. And we spend another $30 billion trying to lose weight from eating all that fast food. Eating fast food, they calculate, costs public health half a trillion dollars a year. And the author says, eating in the United States has become a form of high-risk behavior. So here's some of the gems from his book. So you don't have to read the book. I'm going to bring out some of the best here this morning. We spend more on fast food than new cars, higher education, and computers combined. We spend more money on fast food than new cars, computers, and higher education combined. We spend four times more on fast food than we do books. So we're getting fatter and dumber all the time. But it's taking less time because it's fast food, okay? 2 cents out of every French fry purchase goes to the farmer who grew the potatoes. How's that, potato farmers? A medium Coke, at the time the book was written, a medium Coke McDonald's contains 3.5 ounces of Coke syrup, or about 10 cents worth of Coke syrup. But we pay $1.30 for that same Coke. And so the obesity rate among young adults and children has risen to twice it was in the 1960s, 25%. So fast food has impacted our health, and it also has impacted how we process and market food. And how we view the eating experience, how the process of eating has changed because of fast food. And here's a sign of the end of civilization. We now have, I think there's another photo, yes. We now have chocolate toothpaste, okay? So you say, kids, let's have dessert and brush our teeth at the same time. So that, to me, that's the end of civilization as we know it. Frederick Buechner says that man does not live by bread alone, but he won't live very long without it either. Food is life-giving, but if we eat the wrong food over time, there are toxic consequences. Food serves for more than caloric intake, okay? So for the first time in history, we can eat fast. In all of history, we've never been able to eat fast. We can now eat fast. We can get the meal over with and get on to more important things, as if there were things more important than the eating experience, if the eating experience is merely to take in calories to keep doing the other thing. We can now eat alone on a daily basis. So we can eat fast and we can eat alone. The problem is we eat to stay alive, but we eat together to thrive. There's something more profound in that process, the eating experience, than just getting food into our mouths and chewing it and getting into our system. And thirdly, we can eat and be distracted at the same time. So now you can pull through the drive-thru and drive off eating, driving, and texting at the same time. That's a wonderful combination, eating, texting, and driving at the same time. There are restaurants now that they ask you to check your cell phone at the door. There are also restaurants, a few restaurants, that will give you a 10% discount if you don't use your cell phone during the meal. Some people put, when they get sit down to eat, they'll put all their cell phones in the middle of the table, and whoever takes up their cell phone first pays for the meal for everyone at the table. And so we've gotten to the point where it's normal to eat fast. It's normal to eat alone, and it's normal to eat and be distracted, okay? We've profoundly changed that whole experience just in the last 20, 30 years, okay? But I'm not trying to discourage you from going to McDonald's. I remember about 25 years ago, McDonald's came to Brasilia for the first time. It was the first fast food restaurant to come to Brasilia. And at that time, this movie had not come out, okay? Had I known, I still would have gone to McDonald's. But it was an emotional experience. I was young, and we were about to have kids. And it was emotional to go to a fast food restaurant for the first time in Brazil. The problem is that the fast food industry is ruining, it's taking a big bite out of, if you will, the spiritual value of eating. See, eating reminds us that we constantly depend upon God. And so when we eat three times a day, we eat 7 days a week, we can't go without eating, reminds us that we're dependent upon someone other than ourselves. And the further we are away from that process, the easier it is to forget that we're connected to God, okay? And I'm preaching to farmers. Some of you all are farmers, and you understand that. So we're removed from that, and we sit down. We don't sit at a table. We sit alone, and it's been robbed of all of its social and spiritual profoundness. We didn't grow it. We didn't harvest it. Now we don't even have to cook it or clean up after ourselves. We can just get it down as fast as we can and get on to more important things. So now we can bank, we can shop, and even eat alone for the first time in history. So God created food and the experience for us to grow physically and socially and spiritually. Eating food with other people can be a life-giving experience. It fills our bellies and our spirits at the same time. The social aspect and the fellowship aspect often outlive the memory of meals that we have together. Some of the best times in our memories are of meals that we share, sometimes just a cup of coffee, sometimes a piece of pie and a cup of coffee, sometimes a huge meal and a banquet. But it was significant because of who we ate it with and what happened during that meal. Eating together is one of God's recipes for spiritual nutrition. And so the question for today is, how do we partake of the Lord's Supper in a culture that has undermined the spiritual significance of eating together and taking our time to eat and eliminated so much of the social aspect? Well, I've been a Christian for more than 40 years, and I've taken the Lord's Supper for more than 2,000 times. How do I take the Lord's Supper today without being distracted? When I'm used to having a different rhythm for eating, when it has a significance that's much more shallow than what God intended it. The other thing is, how are we supposed to take the Lord's Supper? Who here has had a class on how you actually take the Lord's Supper? Now, I think we've all heard class and sermons on the significance of the Lord's Supper, but how are you supposed to do it? What are you supposed to do during the Lord's Supper? Close your eyes, open your eyes, cross your eyes. Can you look around? Can you talk to other people during the Lord's Supper? Who's had a class on that? What are you supposed to do? What are you supposed to think about? How do you keep? Can you pray? Can you sing? Can you hum? And if you don't hum well, can you ask Stan to sit next to you and hum for you some religious song? What can we do? How do we take the Lord's Supper? And we learn by pretty much we've watched other people do it, and we kind of get real reverent and all that, but exactly what's supposed to happen? And how can we make it meaningful because we do it every week? Now, I've visited other churches, and there's some good things about other churches, some things I don't like. One of the things I don't like about most churches is they don't take the Lord's Supper every Sunday. We're one of the churches that does that. But how do you do that every week and make it meaningful, but we've never been taught? What do you do? How do you make it meaningful? How do you keep from being distracted? In a culture that glorifies fast and efficient, okay? And I've been in a leadership role for 30 years, and we've often discussed, how do you make this thing, if not drag out too long, but at the same time, it needs to be meaningful. But also without upsetting people that they've got a certain way they do it, but we've never been taught how we're supposed to do it, But the way we're doing it, that's how we feel. That's the way you're supposed to do it. Did I clear that up for everyone? And so for me, and we're going to present this case this morning, the Lord's Supper is not an efficient nor an exclusively private experience. I think, especially living most of my adult life overseas, we've Americanized the Lord's Supper to the exclusion of the social aspect, the togetherness, the communion. Did you take communion today? Okay? And so we isolate it, kind of like, I think we have another fascinating photo here. There. See that? Most of you know that. Some of you don't. That's a phone booth. Okay? Two things happen in a phone booth. You make phone calls. Okay? And that's where Superman changes clothes. Okay? Those are the two things that happen in a phone booth. Okay? We've got it so that the Lord's Supper is almost like we're each in our little phone booths taking the Lord's Supper. And we don't take communion together. It reminds me of a story of two graduate students in seminary. And they both got up about the same time. But one, they're in this small room, they're in the dormitory. And one, every morning, first thing he did, he got on his knees and he prayed. Okay? The other one was getting about his business. He was dressing, showering, getting his books together, blah, blah, blah. And so the guy praying, every time this guy made his roommate, his friend made too much noise, he kind of in his prayer. He kind of made it known that he's aggravating him in his prayers, okay? And finally, the guy who's trying to get things done says, "Hey, Fred, your relationship with God is your relationship with God is causing problems in our relationship." What does the Lord's Supper in our relationship with God have to do with the Lord's Supper in our relationship with other people? In a fast food culture, relationships get in the way. If you go up to the drive-up and there's 10 cars there, those people are preventing you from getting up there and getting your business done. Okay, if you go to Whataburger and there's a lot of people in line, those people are interfering. Or if they're sitting at your favorite table, they're interfering. Or if they're talking too loud on their cell phones, they're interfering with you and what you want to get done. People seem to only get in the way of we just want to get the meal over. And thinking about other people during the Lord's Supper sure can mess things up, especially if it's people that we're having problems with. What do you do about other people during the Lord's Supper? Well, one of our favorite passages on Lord's Supper is in Corinthians, okay? And in the context, I'm going to take several phrases from 1 Corinthians 10 and 11. Okay, 11:18, Paul says, "Divisions among you." And later on in verse 22, "Do you despise the church?" Verse 29, "Without recognizing the body." And then in chapter 10, on the communal event, he says, "Participation in the body." The next verse, "Many form one body." Three times in chapter 11, "Come together to take the Lord's Supper." Verse 33, "Partake together." And 33, 34, "Partake together of one loaf, one cup." Now, just hearing those phrases from when Paul is talking in the context of the Lord's Supper, it's possible that when we take the Lord's Supper, it's not just about us and God. In fact, that's what the problem was there. They were getting together to take the Lord's Supper, but they really weren't taking the Lord's Supper. They weren't togethering. They were just taking. That's not a word, okay? Togethering. But they weren't togethering. They were just taking the Lord's Supper. It was too individualistic. It's a personal event, and it's also an interpersonal event. And so let's go to the passage in Luke, that was read this morning. So they're getting ready to take the Passover meal. This is one of the major events in the Jewish religion. And it's a family event. They get together as a family to take of the Passover. And in this meal, Jesus wants to give a new significance to the meal. In it, he wants to show that he's going to pay the price for our sins against God and our sins against one another. And so the Lord's Supper is taken together like a family in community. And Jesus didn't eat his last meal alone. He was not like a prisoner on death row that ordered, you know, his favorite food, and he just ate it alone and he scarfed it down. He didn't take it with angels either. He took it with 12 pretty profoundly imperfect disciples. They were flawed. They were inferior to him. They didn't all have the correct theology. They didn't treat him as he deserved to be treated. They would fail him. They would let him down. They would eventually abandon him. And he ate with them, not just as their Lord, but as their brother. He decided not to hold a grudge against them. He did not wait until they had gotten their lives straightened out and when they deserved to eat with him. John Ortberg, in his book, Everyone is Normal Till You Get to Know Them, says, sooner or later, every person has the capacity to get on our nerves, to irritate, to offend, even sin against us. That's when we prepare ourselves for the Lord's Supper. When someone is aggravating us, when someone is testing our patience, when someone has something against us, that's when we're preparing for the Lord's Supper, because it is a communal event. It is something we do together. That's when the work really begins, not just the 1 or 2 or 3 minutes we take the Lord's Supper. The preparation is taking place all week long in how we treat one another, and we're working to work out relationships with our wives who irritate us, our husbands who irritate us, our kids, our parents, our friends, our co-workers, our elders, our song leaders, our preacher, our secretary. That's how we prepare for the Lord's Supper. We need each other to be able to understand what's going on with the Lord's Supper. So it came to the day of the unleavened bread, and Jesus longed to eat with them. He broke bread with them. Jews didn't cut bread. That was sacrilegious, to cut bread. So he broke the bread. And he says, in this breaking of the bread, he says, I welcome you. I accept you as family. You are my brothers. We're all on the same playing field. We're all equal. Well, this wasn't exactly your band of brothers he took the Lord's Supper with. One of them, one of the top three that he often went off with, would deny him 3 times, and he predicted it. Now, he predicted it, and Peter still denied him. Now, that's bizarre. It's as if I would say, Stan, on the way home, you're going to be ticketed for speeding, and when the cop pulls you over and comes next to your car, you're going to get out of the car and whoop them. And they're going to call backups, and they're going to whoop you pretty bad. And you're not going to Kansas because you'll never get out of the hospital. Okay. Now, if Stan believed me, if I was Jesus saying that, what would Stan do? He would walk home. He would stay here today and say, hey, he said Sunday, tomorrow. He'd get a ride home, he'd take a taxi, he'd crawl home, he'd jog home. He'd do everything to make sure my prophecy wouldn't be fulfilled. Jesus prophesied it, Peter denied him, and Jesus still took the Lord's Supper with him. Right after he'd washed their feet, prayed for them, had the Lord's Supper, they continued arguing about who's going to be the most important. They didn't understand the Lord's Supper. They were arguing about who's going to take over. And Jesus still took the Lord's Supper with them. They didn't have it all together. He still took the Lord's Supper. One of them would betray him, and he predicted it. 2 things that are amazing about this. One is, he said, one of you is going to betray me. And they all murmured and discussed among themselves, is it one of us? Who is it? Now, if it were me, and I'd had some guys following me, and I knew one of them was going to betray me, you'd know who that person is. How would you know that? Because I'd treat them differently. I'd pull some other guys together, some of the disciples, and I would badmouth them behind his back. Everyone would know, obviously, who's going to betray me because I wouldn't treat him the same. Jesus treated them all the same, treated Judas and loved him and served him the same as the others. So much so, he says, one is going to betray me, and they didn't all go, it's Judas. He's a thief. He's been taking money. It's him. And the second thing is, Jesus took the Lord's Supper with Judas. They all abandoned the mission. On that same evening, Resurrection Sunday, the followers gathered together behind locked doors in fear that some of the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem were still searching for them. So they didn't obey the Great Commission. They were ruled by fear more than faith. They gave up. They were hiding. And Jesus still took the Lord's Supper with all of them. In fact, in another gospel, he rebuked them for their hard hearts. They had hard hearts, and he still took the Lord's Supper with them. I eagerly desire to eat this Passover with you. And so the Lord's Supper is not about how amazing, the first Lord's Supper was not about how amazing the 12 disciples were. They were silly, they were stupid, they were fearful, they were flawed. They ran away, they betrayed, they denied. He washed their feet, and he ate his last meal with them. He broke bread and said, you are my brothers. I'm having communion with you. That's how the first Lord's Supper started. So do we have time for the movie clip? Okay. One of my favorite movies of all time, Places in the Heart. Have you seen that movie? No movie houses here in El Campo? Okay. It's about cotton farmers in Waxahachie, Texas. Okay? And it's during the Great Depression. Okay? And this is before the Civil Rights Movement and integration, okay? And Sally Field's in the movie. She won her second Oscar. She went up and made the famous You Like Me, You Really Like Me speech. John Malkovich was discovered. Danny Glover was discovered in this movie. And Ed Harris. This was their breakout movie. Okay, and so in the first scene, the sheriff, Sally Field's husband, who's also the cotton farmer, he's accidentally killed by a young African-American boy. And then he is summarily dragged through the streets dead to show what they do to African-Americans who even accidentally kill the sheriff. Okay, this is the last scene. I don't know of any movie that ends with the Lord's Supper, except if it's Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. If it's one of those movies, it ends with the Lord's Supper. Three things you'll notice. The first couple to take the Lord's Supper is Ed Harris, and that's his wife, and he'd committed adultery, and she had not communicated with him. Okay, they're the first ones. Second thing to notice, when they look out on the church, how many people were there, and then you're going to notice that's going to change. And the last scene is, we'll talk about that, okay? The last scene of the movie.
This morning, we take our text from 1 Corinthians, the 13th chapter, verses 1 through 8. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, and have not love, I am become as a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and all knowledge, and have not love, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor and have not love, it profiteth me nothing. Love is patient, kind. Love is not jealous or boastful. Love never ends. Crucifixion, our Lord gathered with his disciples. He broke the bread and blessed it, saying, "Take, eat, this is my body." And he took the cup and said, "Drink, this is my blood, which I shed for thee."
Don't want you to take away from this clip that I came here to show kids taking communion and instrumental music during the Lord's Supper. That is not why I showed this. I showed it one, is there's, I've never seen a movie end like this. And it had to mean something that Robert Benton, who's from Waxahachie, Texas, decided to end his movie this way. The last scene there is of the sheriff who was killed during the first scene and the boy who accidentally killed him. And so this is a preview for the banquet we're going to have in heaven. That's what the Lord's Supper is. We declare the resurrection of Jesus and how he brings us all together. We're practicing for that time when we're all going to be together, feasting together. Every time we eat together, every time we partake of food together, but especially the Lord's Supper, we're declaring we are all equal. We forgive one another as the body of Christ.